It's Friday, December 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, the U.S. Defense Secretary calls for tougher action against Islamic State.
If the Chinese government was serious about eradicating torture, it would follow that roadmap.
Human rights advocates slam China's record. Also ahead, questions remain about the California shootings. Who are the top R&B and hip-hop artists of 2015? See if you agree with us. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. In his first remarks before a U.S. congressional committee since the attacks in Paris and California, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter pledged a greater U.S. effort to inflict a lasting defeat on the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Carter, in testimony Wednesday before the Senate Armed Services Committee, said U.S. Special Forces and the U.S. trained and equipped programs are confronting Islamic State fighters in Syria, while air power and advisors are helping Peshmerga forces in northern Iraq. And he says the United States is augmenting Iraqi forces in their bid to retake the provincial Iraqi capital of Ramadi, captured by Islamic State fighters in May.
After a frustratingly long time, we are starting to see some movement in the operation to recapture Ramadi. Over the past several months, the coalition has provided specialized training and equipment, including combat engineering techniques like in-stride breaching and bulldozing, and munitions like AT-4 shoulder-fired missiles to stop truck bombs. All to the Iraqi army and its counterterrorism service units that are now beginning to enter Ramadi neighborhoods from multiple directions. The United States is prepared to assist the Iraqi army with additional unique capabilities to help them finish the job, including attack helicopters and accompanying advisors, if circumstances dictate and if requested by Prime Minister Abadi. In full coordination again with the government of Iraq, we're deploying a specialized expeditionary targeting force to assist the ISF and Kurdish Peshmerga forces and put even more pressure on ISIL through a variety of raids and intelligence gathering missions. This force will also be in a position to conduct unilateral operations in Syria.
But Carter cautioned a greater U.S. ground combat presence in either country could shatter the fragile coalition of fighters united against the Islamic State and enable that group to call for jihad. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Ambassador James Jeffrey. He's a former senior diplomat to Baghdad and now with the Washington Institute on Near East Asia Affairs. He says he was encouraged by the Carter testimony.
It's a step in the right direction, but we have to get beyond this idea that this war is all about what we will not do. This war has to be what we have to do, which is to take ground back from ISIS. Ramadi is the target right now. The last 98 kilometers of the Turkish border that ISIS controls is next. Eventually, there's Mosul and Raqqa. That's the only way we're going to defeat this scourge. And what ISIS is doing is an extraordinary the effect. I just got finished reading that the Kurds are under tremendous pressure. Their economy is being crushed, among other things, by the Russians constantly closing airspace to fire cruise missiles over Kurdistan territory. Well, Baghdad, of course, is not too unhappy with that because they find Kurdistan to be difficult, so they're not going to block the Russian overflight clearance. And the Russians would do it anyway, but it's, of course, the only justification for it is supposedly to hit ISIS, although they're not attacking ISIS, of course. But this is just another indication of how not just ISIS is totally destabilizing the globe through its terrorist attacks and its occupation of territory, but this unholy alliance of Iran, Syria, and Russia claiming to be fighting ISIS is basically pulling apart the security structures of the Middle East. In some areas, special forces and attack helicopters might be enough. That's Ramadi. In other areas, Raqqa and Mosul, I don't think so.
Mr. Carter, when pressed about a larger U.S. ground presence in the area, suggested that the fragile coalition that is fighting ISIS may, in fact, turn against the U.S. forces.
That's a particular concern about the Shia militias. And the way to do that is, one, make it clear that we're only going in there to seize terrain, not to hold terrain, not to be an occupying force. Two, to make it clear to these people and to the Iranians that the United States sees a real threat from ISIS to our NATO allies. Look at Turkey and France and the hundreds of people that have been killed in ISIS attacks. But now look at us, and that we're going to do what's necessary to take them down.
Ambassador Jeffrey says the call for Turkey and Gulf Arab states to do more to fight the Islamic State threat in the region is not credible. He says they can only make a marginal contribution with small, untested forces, and he says their political commitment coupled with a token force would be very helpful. Well, staying with the Middle East, it looks like we continue to see the aftermath of billionaire Donald Trump's proposal on banning Muslim immigration. International Edition's social media guru is G. Abby Lee. She's right here in Studio 22 with details. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Now, do you remember when our Senate correspondent Jim Malone said that Trump's proposal would have repercussions beyond the U.S.? And it turns out he's right in the money. One of the trending stories on Facebook today is how an international department store chain dropped his line of products immediately after the comment. That department store is Landmark, which has 190 stores in the Middle East, Africa, and Pakistan. Landmark announced it would pull all Trump merchandise off its shelves, and judging by media reports, the move is already happening.
I see. So which media outlets are reporting, and what's the detail?
The Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. The NYT article is titled, Donald Trump Loses Luster When Words Reach the Middle East. The Landmark Group removed all Trump-branded products from the shelves of its home furnishing store hours after he called for a ban on the entry of Muslims into the U.S. Now, the foundation of Trump's business, of course, is his name, so when people don't like him, his business is going to suffer. The Trump brand is used in a wide range of industries, from upscale golf courses and residences to home furnishings and accessories.
Well, perhaps a symbol of American success, you might say. How is Trump taking in all this news?
Well, he didn't tweet about it at all, but he did send out a number of tweets about the latest poll conducted by CBS News and the New York Times. And it reads like this. Thank you for your support. Being hashtag politically correct will not hashtag make America great again. So that's not his really priority. Mm. The latest poll result shows Trump leading the Republican nomination at 35%, followed by Ted Cruz and Ben Carson. Jim?
Wow, amazing. The numbers still go up. Well, thanks for being here today, G. And that, of course, was G. Abby Lee. She tweets from our Twitter account at @VOA_IE. Also, she has her very own account, @GAbbyLee. And you can follow me if you wish as well, @VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thursday was International Human Rights Day, and a UN committee marked the occasion to slam China's human rights situation, especially in regard to lawyers. Prominent human rights lawyer Pu Shicheng, who has defended artist Ai Weiwei, will go on trial next week. International Edition host Sarah Williams speaks with Sophie Richardson, China director at Human Rights Watch.
The UN's Committee Against Torture has issued a pretty scathing indictment of China's record on that subject in particular, and it makes some very strong recommendations about eradicating torture by, first of all, minimizing the amount of time somebody can be held before they're brought before a judge so that they aren't held by the police for more than a month at a time. It also urges that they have access to a lawyer from the moment they're deprived of liberty. It calls for an end to the use of restraints, solitary confinement, investigations about abuses of North Koreans or Tiananmen survivors. It's a very thoroughgoing and historical document. And if the Chinese government was serious about eradicating torture, it would follow that roadmap.
It seems as though human rights lawyers, at least within the last, you know, it means for a while, but certainly within this past year, the past few months, have been singled out for a special treatment by Chinese authorities.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There was a remarkable, really unprecedented roundup of human rights lawyers across China between July and September. And more than 20 of those people are still detained and or disappeared. And it doesn't seem to be enough for the authorities to prevent these people from doing their work and taking cases to court. They've also really stepped up public rhetoric, demonizing the very idea of using courts as a way of protecting human rights. And I think that's a pretty alarming regression from where we were about a decade ago.
A prominent human rights lawyer, Pu Zhixiang, is apparently will be tried next week. He has been detained, I believe, for quite a while, but he is also one of China's most prominent human rights lawyers.
Yeah, he is really the canary in the coal mine, I think, for this community these days. He's a very well-known, very well-regarded lawyer who has worked on, you know, some very high-profile cases on issues ranging from religious freedom to labor rights. He has been detained for about a year and a half now, which is, of course, wildly beyond what law and procedure should allow. And he is scheduled to be tried on Monday, largely on the basis of some online postings, all of which were entirely within the confines of peaceful expression as guaranteed by Chinese and international law. And we're really encouraging global attention to the outcome of this case, because I think if he is found guilty, you know, then really nobody is safe anymore in this realm of activism.
Sophie Richardson, China Director at Human Rights Watch. A fundraising campaign started by Muslim Americans to help the families of those killed in last week's mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, has raised nearly $175,000. Faisal Qazi, a neurologist who works for a private nonprofit organization in San Bernardino, began a local online campaign, Muslims United for San Bernardino, on the crowdfunding website LaunchGood, which is dedicated to assisting Muslim initiatives in the United States and abroad. As the campaign neared its initial fundraising goal, Qazi and his friends took the campaign national, and donations to the LaunchGood website rose dramatically, with many large donations coming from Muslim American advocacy groups. Tariq El Masidi, the campaign's fundraising director, says another goal of the campaign is to show the public that Muslim Americans are active contributors to American society. Meanwhile, the investigation continues into the shooting by Syed Rizwan Farouk and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, that killed 14 people. VOA's Ken Bredemeyer has the latest details in a discussion with International Edition host Susan Yaki.
Authorities now seem to be focusing a lot on, first of all, how Tashfeen Malik was radicalized in Pakistan, and her husband as well, but also a friend of Farouk's, a next-door neighbor, lived near him for several years, and is believed to have sold or given the weapons, a couple of the automatic weapons that Farouk and his wife used to kill the 14 people. What's their relationship? For one thing, this man, Enrique Marquez, is telling investigators that he and Farouk planned a 2012 terrorist action of some sort, but got cold feet, backed out, for the simple reason that authorities at the time were arresting other people in other plots, and they got worried that they could be in the crosshairs of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as well. So that plot didn't happen, but certainly U.S. investigators want to know more about it.
Now they believe this couple was radicalized long before the shooting.
Not only before the shooting, before they got married. One of the original theories of the case was that perhaps the woman in this case, Tashfeen Malik, had radicalized her husband. That seems not to be the case as investigators delve further into it, that they both were radicalized, that they both had a sense of wanting to commit some kind of a terrorist action. As they met online, as they got to know each other, they dated, if you will, courted each other, and got married, came to the U.S.
Is there any sign the pair were actually part of an organized terror organization?
Federal authorities don't seem to think so. That question has been raised repeatedly, and investigators have not uncovered something in that vein at this point. They believe that the two were self-radicalized and came to be a joint husband and wife assault team carrying out this massacre in California last week.
VOA's Ken Breedemeyer. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Well, you know it was going to happen. Billboard magazine has released its year-end lists for 2015. International Edition's David Byrd sits down with the lady DJ, Shauna Renee, about which artists and songs topped the R&B and hip-hop lists for the past year.
You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love.
Drake dominated this year. Not only did he dominate this list, which is Billboard's list of top R&B and hip-hop artists, but he's been dominating lists, Spotify lists, MTV lists, you name it. He's at the top of the list because 2015 was such an incredible year for him. He released, if you're reading this, It's Too Late, which was his album. This year, he also released a mixtape with Future. He went on tour. You know, he's just kind of been all over the place. He has this incredible video out now that everyone loves and is talking about. So he came out on top of this Billboard list of artists.
I can feel my face when I'm with you. My love is.
Now, The Weeknd, if you've been listening to pop music at all,
right,
you've heard I Can't Feel My Face. But he had 12 currently charting songs at the same time?
Yeah. Weeknd has not only dominated the R&B charts, but he dominated the Hot 100 artist charts, digital song charts, streaming charts, and then also on the R&B side, they're like these adult R&B charts, and these are kind of songs that appeal to an older audience, and he's dominating those charts as well. I mean, though this was the year of Drake, Weeknd was not far behind.
Now, we talked about some of the folks, some of the other folks on this list. Let's start with Fetty Wap.
So Fetty Wap is this hip-hop artist. He's kind of like what we call a trap artist. And so his song, Trap Queen, was sort of has become sort of like an anthem. And, I mean, MTV embraced him, and then all of a sudden, everyone else started to as well. And some people might consider his music an acquired taste. It certainly took me a little while to get into it. But once I did, I realized that he is actually something special. He really is, I think, unique in that he's very authentic. He talks about his experiences. And if you kind of keep it in the context of which it is being created, you understand
don't
that.
Do it for me. Now watch me whip. Kill it. Now watch me nae-nae. Okay. Now watch me whip. Watch me nae-nae. Why me do it?
There's a couple of acts that got their fame primarily through YouTube and through going viral. Let's start off with Silento. with Watch Me.
Right.
And then you have I Love Memphis with Rock the Kwan.
These are dances. So his song Watch Me is a series of dances that he put together. And Rock the Kwan is a dance. So that's what makes these so special. And so he's in the gym and he's doing, like, I think he said it was maybe a minute. And then he started noticing everyone was uploading videos, doing these dances. And he said, well, let's expand this. He expands it. He puts it on YouTube. It goes viral. He gets signed. And now he's looking to 2016 to maybe be a breakout year for him.
All right. Well, what do you think? Do you have a top 10 list of acts that you followed in 2015? Send a tweet to Shauna. She's at VOA Lady DJ. And you can always log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. We're always out there 24/7 for your reading pleasure. Well, if we had charts to rank directors and engineers, we've got two that would be right at the very top for 2015. Zeynep Abdel-Rahman at the controls for us, and our director, Tracy Carter. Thank you both. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you for joining us. We hope to see you again soon. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On December 10, 1948, still stunned by the horrendous crimes committed against civilian populations during the Second World War, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. At the time, one of the Declaration's chief architects, former First Lady and member of the United States delegation to the United Nations, Eleanor Roosevelt, wrote, "We have found that the conditions of our contemporary world require the enumeration of certain protections which the individual must have if he is to acquire a sense of security and dignity in his own person." Since 1950, the United Nations has celebrated December 10th as Human Rights Day. This day is best known for the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo, Norway. However, cultural events and exhibitions focused on various human rights themes take place around the world. This year's Human Rights Day marks the launch of a year-long campaign to highlight and preview the 50th anniversary of two important human rights documents, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Both documents were adopted by the UN General Assembly on December 16, 1966. Despite the tireless efforts and notable successes of numerous national and international agencies, non-governmental organizations, and activists all over the world, there is still much to be done. On this Human Rights Day, let us resolve to work together as a community of like-minded nations to put an end to these abuses and to hold those responsible for inflicting them to account. Ultimately, our goal is to transform our observation of December 10th as a day not about highlighting human rights abuses across the globe, but rather about commemorating the realization of full and unobstructed human rights for all people everywhere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.